Okay, here we go.
Medical technology, the two words put together in a phrase, is a given these days. Everything from health screenings to medications and often cures are connected to some form of technology. In a special edition of Tech Tuesday, we're going to talk about all of that during a live broadcast of All Sides with Ann Fisher from the OSU Rally for Wellness Health Fair on the campus of Ohio State University. Joining us now to talk about the quickly expanding universe of health-related smartphone apps is Dan Rockwell. He's Program Manager of the Software Prototyping Center at the OSU Technology Commercialization and Knowledge Transfer Office. What a mouthful. Welcome back to the show, Dan.
Yeah, that is. I gotta get that revised.
I think the last time you were around, we talked about changing that. Okay.
I know. My boss always tells me I need to Egg McMuffin up that title.
Exactly.
I don't know what that means.
Well, that sounds kind of unhealthy, too.
It does sound unhealthy. We should stick to the healthy important.
So. We've talked about exercise apps on the show before. Yeah. You talked about the ones that you work on developing at the transfer office. Yeah. The ones that measure how many miles you walk in a day, for example. Everybody knows about those now. What else is out there? Just give us that broad spectrum of what we can talk about later.
Well, yeah, you have all the standard apps, right? The pedometer, the apps that are like a food log, right? And even like a blood pressure app where you put in your blood pressure readings and all that kind of stuff. And now there's sort of a new emergence of apps such as Tally apps, which you can actually define all the things that you want to track in your daily life. Like for me, maybe I want to note all the times I'm either happy, sad, moody.
Really?
Yeah, or like I'm frustrated or my back hurts. I can start creating my own little dashboard on my phone and note those times when they happen. And then over time, I can do a graph of that and look at patterns. I can notice that every time I'm on the radio with Ann, I'm always happy and excited. See, that's kind of cool. And I can look at my own patterns. And so those apps are starting to come out, which are really empowering people, mostly the sort of the data scientist in people. But that's becoming more and more common, I think, because people are getting more and more familiar with data around their lives and the metrics around themselves. And then the other category of apps, which is really interesting, are sort of like the gamification of health. So there's an app out there called Super Better. It's from Jane McGonigal. And she's actually an adjunct professor here at OSU, talks in the psychology and the wellness department. And she's got a really it's like a gamification app where it's all about understanding, you know, the demons in your life and figuring out how to take apart the stress and then also how to feel better about every day.
How are we gamifying this?
Well, it's kind of crazy. It is. It's like a game, but you say, you know, what frustrates you in life, you list that, and then it gives you activities to try to get over that stress. And then you sort of play this game to get better. And you're actually seeing that in fitness apps as well. Apps that are like dare you. You're like, I bet you can't do 10 push-ups. I bet you suck. So you're like, oh, I can't do 10 push-ups, and I'll show you app, right? You know, and you put the information in there, and it's sort of like psychology that's getting it's getting sucked into the app to make it more engaging and make it more fun.
Some people would say, oh, you know, every time I do this, I've got to do some kind of input. But like you said, the generations are changing now, and more people are familiar. They're growing up with it.
Yeah, they're growing up with it. And the device is getting smarter, too. I mean, it's got the accelerometer in it. It can figure out your walking, your steps. You can get, you know, these other devices. I'm wearing all this jewelry for you here. like the Fitbit or the Jawbone Up that I have on. They'll passively track that information so you don't have to think about it. They're just not as engaging. The apps are more engaging because they actually suck you in to here's why you're getting healthy, here's how it benefits your body, and here's what you should do in case you don't do it. You're going to end up like this slug over here. You don't want to be like that slug, dude. No, I don't. All right, so then educate me and make it fun. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dan Rockwell. He's a program manager for the Software Prototyping Center at the Technology Commercialization and Knowledge Transfer at OSU. If you have a question or comment for him, we're talking about health-related apps. There's a lot more where that came from. If you have any questions, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. How do weight loss apps work? What do they do with those? Is that just like calorie counters on a smartphone?
Yeah, calorie counter apps. They basically, you put in your weight and your information in it, and it tells you, hey, you should only be eating 3,000 calories a day. And then it recommends, it asks you to track your food. So you put in, and it has, most of them have really powerful databases where they look at everything. If you went to an Applebee's, you went to a Subway, all that nutrition information.
You can just scan them now?
Not so much scan. Okay. There's probably apps that do the scan, but they'll be listed. So if you say, I had the avocado sub at Subway, it would pull it right up and say, here's a calorie, and here's all the vitamin information and everything else. and you say, I've had that. Okay, sweet. And then it just shows you, you know, like, all right, you have 500 calories left today. This is all you can eat. If you go over that, it starts yelling at you. Passively yells. It just shows you.
It's not like that little envelope from Harry Potter.
It should. That would be awesome tech. I wait for that. That would be great.
Start screaming at you.
Yeah. In fact, what's funny is that most of the apps don't really yell at you yet. And I think that's the next thing that people are starting to put into the apps is the psychology of nagging and saying, hey, man, you only got 500 calories left. I suggest you walk the stairs and, you know, not you know, take the elevator, that kind of thing. I think a lot of apps are about trying to change your behavior and reward you for better decisions because well, you just had Clay Meyershon here talking about P4 medicine. Everything is about all those decisions you make, right? Like, I made a bad decision on the way. I parked in the parking garage, right? I should have probably walked all the way.
I made a bad decision. I parked too far.
So, okay, so you can have two different kinds of bad decisions, right? But it's like, you know you should have walked here. Of course, my boss would be yelling at me. He's like, you should have walked. Come on, you're carrying an extra child with you all the time. You should walk.
I just want to remind folks that we are at the OSU Rally for Wellness Health Fair on the campus of Ohio State University. It is not open to the public, unfortunately, but
we can just walk in.
Faculty and staff. But it is a great. But there are a lot of people here who care about health, and yes, we thought it would be a great opportunity to talk about it today. Yes. And to meet our family at OSU. So, do these things really work?
If you get sucked into them, yes.
Okay.
if you really, I think the apps for tracking and understanding fitness are popular and they work. Like the other day, I was at the pool with my wife, and I was looking up an app to show me how to do different exercises in the pool. And that was cool. I read about 7 exercises that I could do. Now I can get in the 8 feet and do those exercises, and I felt empowered. So the app educated me. I did it. It wasn't really interactive at that point. It's just informing me.
Mm-hmm.
I think apps that you use for exercise, and like I have a food tracker app. I use that all the time. It lets me know whether or not I'm going to be going over my calories or less. And it forces me to be realistic. I think the technologies like the Fitbit are much more engaging in that they're in your pocket all the time. They're always tracking your steps. You know, you want to do 10,000 steps a day, it'll tell you, hey, you got 3,000 steps left to do. My wife's addicted to her Fitbit. She's always using it, walking around. And then she'll come back and celebrate. You know, she celebrates what the app is telling her, that kind of stuff. So I do think they do work, but you have to be open to them working. If you're not, then you're just, you know, passively curious and not really.
How many apps are out there now?
On the
health related?
On the wellness side, there's probably I'd say more than 4,000 apps. It's just a massive category of apps. Because you think about it, every person here in this fair,
which
probably
is
could
be
have
about 3,000 by the end of
yeah,
the
yeah, they could have an app. They could have an app to do different things.
Well, is it a big deal in app development now? Because
yeah.
I know we talked about gaming the last time you were on, and we talked about what a big deal that is and how everybody wants to have that next great gaming idea.
Yeah.
But with health, it's big?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I think with health and wellness apps, there's a bigger opportunity because you have so many people who are trying to lose weight, trying to feel better, how to de-stress. There's so many apps that you can listen to at night to relax you. I mean, and there's so many broad different categories. And I think everyone's really fascinated with their own body data, their own ability to go, I weighed this, now I weigh this, and I achieved something, right? You can feel the result. And when you feel the result and you attach that feeling and that emotion to an app or some device that helped you do it, you become fiercely loyal, right? I mean, that's what Apple does, right? Apple makes a great product. You start to emotionally bond to it, and then you're like, I got to have it, right? And then you become an Apple fanatic, right? Apps and technology are the same way. If they have a real impact on you, you'll carry that with you, and you'll use it and continue to use it, and then you'll use it as a, this is what saved my life, right? This is what really helped me. And it's something you can work with every day, whereas your doctor you see every 6 months, right? And he lets you know, do better. Well, thanks. You know, that's what my doctor says. My doctor says, offer it up. Go work out, you know. He doesn't ever give me a drug. He never gives me a drug.
You mentioned relaxation apps. There are apps that are intended to relax you. What are those like?
Well, there's apps that you can listen to music and listen to someone talking to you, right? You could get the Ann Fisher relaxation app. But they're really just about helping you learn how to meditate and relax. And so there's those kinds of apps. And there's a lot of them. My wife uses one to sleep at night. It just gives her like a rainforest sound. And they're really simple to make. That's the other thing, too, is that you can make a relaxation app really simple. I was just talking to people over there that do the polarity stuff. And I'm like, you should have an app. You know, what would I do? Well, yeah. Put all your best practices and polarity into an app. Show people, empower other people to figure out how to master your techniques. And don't see it as a way of, oh, I'm going to lose my secret sauce.
As competition.
Yeah, don't see it as that. Uh-huh. See it as a way of, when you enable me, I'm empowered. And then I tell somebody else, and it all goes back to you in the end. Through like sort of the karma aspect. You know, it's going to get back to you eventually. And you might make a product, and you might it might lead to an ebook or something like that.
I love that we're talking about karma during a tech show.
Yeah,
I think
kinda
that's
cool,
really kind of cool. Yeah, I really
yeah.
do.
Well, I'm a deep person. Yeah.
What are some of the mistakes that app developers make when it comes to health-related or wellness apps?
I think when they play with privacy, if they share private data, like if I was putting my weight information into the app. And then they were going to use that weight information on a report somewhere and actually connect my name to it, I would be pissed, right? Mm-hmm. Well, you don't have right to. So apps really have to sort of make sure that when they're enabling people to collect data, they need to allow it so that I can give it to you without my privacy going, you know, sort of taken off of it. Another thing that a lot of apps do is they assume that you want to share everything with Facebook. So you're like, you're losing weight in the app, and then the app is connected to Facebook and telling everybody, like, Dan used to weigh 400, but now he weighs 305, you know,
or
whatever.
Conversely.
Yeah, right. Exactly. He's gone up in weight, by the way. Congratulate him, you know. That would suck. But I think it's that assumption that we want to share with our social networks. There's too many people to just assume, because Facebook exists, of course, everything should be on there. No. You've got to give me permission. And one, you should find out whether or not you should even have it in the app in the first place. I think there's too much piling on the features, right? So they're like, I want to show you how to do it, then I want to hold your hand to do it, and then, heck, I just want to just step into your life, and I'll lose the weight for you because you're too, you know, slow to do it. Those are bad decisions.
What about monitoring apps like blood sugar, that kind of thing? Are those... those can save lives if
totally,
they're used right.
Totally, you know. Totally. We do a blood pressure app at home, but it doesn't connect with an actual blood pressure device. It's just that I have an electronic monitoring system I use at home, and then I put it into a data record. And then when I go and talk to the doctor, I can give him my report, and he can look at it and go, okay, this is good. So I'm actually going to help the doctor out because I'm collecting the data for myself and to share it with him. Now, I'm waiting for the day where the device will actually slap into the actual docking port, right? So it'll actually physically connect here and I wrap around my arm and do it for me and be like, boop, you know, that would be awesome. But that device is obviously, you know, a couple $100s versus me buying the standalone unit and putting the information. So like the blood glucose monitors, the blood pressure monitors, even a lot of the sleep systems, they're still separate from the device. They're not connected to the phone just yet. They're more like, it's all about you collecting data,
plugging
data
it
in the system and logging it. But that logging is important, especially if you're like a cardiac rehab patient. You know, the more data you have on how you're recovering is huge. You don't want to have another cardiac episode, right? So you got to capture that data. And then once you get into your data, you're going to start really seeing the patterns of it. And you get empowered by it, and then you start understanding your stress levels and everything else that cause that.
And there are the clinical apps,
oh, yeah.
The so-called clinical apps. That's what doctors and other healthcare professionals use to do their jobs. But I imagine that's expanding exponentially as a new generation of doctors comes to.
There's actually a big emergence in hospital-related apps. There are actually doctor-to-doctor communication within the hospital. And the biggest barrier there is HIPAA compliance, right? So if they're going to be sharing information about patients, they can do it on a mobile device, but they have to make everything secure network. So you're starting to see a lot of emergence in that area. That's exciting. That's great for OSU, and that's great for technology commercialization because that's a big field.
I always wondered about that long-distance healthcare, too, and this seems like this. Now I start to see it when you talk about apps and that sort of thing. It makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, and there's more people that want to find ways to get in and around HIPAA. I mean, there's some pros and cons to it because it's a standard. Mm-hmm. But then for a lot of folks who have different, like really serious cancer illnesses, they want to do away with those HIPAA standards and get more patients to share information to find a cure, not go through some blockade of policy. And I think that's really warranted. I mean, I think if you're trying to find a solution to an issue, if you can crowdsource the planet to figure out how to fix a wellness problem, that's a good thing to do, right? We all need that data, but there's a lot of blockades mm-hmm. in the current system. So there's a massive revolution in health for sure.
Well, Dan Rockwell, thanks for joining the show again.
All right.
Dan Rockwell, he's Program Manager for the Software Prototyping Center at the Technology Commercialization and Knowledge Transfer of The Ohio State University. It's where they talk about new apps.
That's great. I'll get a better title next time for you.
Okay. Thanks, Dan. Coming up, we're going to hear from Gordon Horwitz. He's founder and CEO of Allostatics. We talked about it last hour, and we'll be back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Another 10,000 baby boomers turned 65 today, give or take a few, and a new survey shows that overall they're happy, healthy, and optimistic about their future. That optimism fades when it comes to paying their medical bills and for the future of Medicare. I'm Lynn Neary, Aging in America, next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. When you support our station at the annual level of $85, our gift to you is the WOSU Public Media Member Card. The Member Card is good for dining and admission discounts at more than 200 Member Card partners in and around Central Ohio. Save money and support 89.7 NPR News with the Member Card. Make a gift of $85 or more. Visit WOSU.org/membercard for more information. And thanks for your support of 89.7 NPR News. 69 degrees with cloudy skies. There is a chance of rain today, a high of 78. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 60. Sunshine for Wednesday and a high of 82. More sunshine on Thursday with a high of 88. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Medical technology, the two words put together in a phrase, is a given these days. Everything from health screenings to medications and often cures are connected to some form of technology these days. In a special edition of Tech Tuesday, we're going to talk about all of that during a live broadcast of All Sides with Ann Fisher from the OSU Rally for Wellness Health Fair on the campus of Ohio State University. Joining us now to talk about the analytical technology behind personalized healthcare is Gordon Horwitz. He's the CEO and founder of Allostatics and CEO of P44U. Allostatics in May entered into a partnership with OSU's Wexner Medical Center to launch a joint venture. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what is Allostatics and how is it involved in P4 medicine development?
Allostatics is an analytical company. It is we develop healthcare analytics to take raw data that is fundamentally useless because it hasn't been analyzed and run it through a series of analytical tools to develop smart data that can either be predictive or screen and help doctors in their ability to diagnose patients earlier, saving money. And we deal more in the preventative medicine side than in the folks that already have acute disease stages.
So how does this measurement differ from others? I was reading about it. It's a neural network-based analytics.
Okay.
What does that mean?
Well,
Ann,
I will tell you this. We are both in the same position. I am not the statistical genius of the company, but I have put together a superb team ranging all the way from OSU's folks to some of the best analytical people in the country. And I did this for a specific reason. All good ideas come from, I believe, from a personal need to have it done. My background is that all of my biometrics and blood analysis were always within range. So if I went to my doctor and I said, "Doc, I'm just feeling lousy, and I have been feeling lousy since 1993, what can you do for me? He would take, I would go and have my preventative medicine screening. He would look at all of my measurements and say to me, Gordon, I love you, but there's nothing I can do for you because everything's within range. In fact, Gordon, I can't even get paid because I don't know what to code this as. So I'm just going to code it as fatigue. So when I came into this business, I had a personal mission, and that was to create an analytic that could examine a human being from their toes to their nose and examine them as a body that is attached, and everything works in sync. So neural networks are computer systems that replicate the human brain. And what they're able to do, as we are able to do, is actually learn, as opposed to another computer that is always 1 + 1 = 2. We know in our lives that somehow comorbidities, which means other parts and pieces that are affecting your body, affect the outcome of where you're going. So the way that we analyze folks are by taking data, longitudinal data, which means you fundamentally have a starting point and an end point, and that starting point means you're asymptomatic or healthy for your age group, and the end point could be morbidity, disease, death, and we then build a neural network that is trained to examine patternization throughout all of this to come up with the score. So fundamentally, it's almost like in the movie Back to the Future, mm-hmm. when Biff had the almanac and he could see the future. That's how he made his money. To be able to do what we do, you can only do it with medically based, evidence-based longitudinal studies, which allows the networks to really examine what is going on in a large cohort of people and then translate it down to a personal story, which is you, meaning, and this is what we can tell you about you.
When you're talking about a cohort, what does that comprise? Is that all the people in the world kind of a cohort, or is it people in my demographic group? What do we mean by that?
I mean, the problem with that is that in terms of cohorts, you have to look at a range of people. You cannot pick and choose your cohort because that would skew the outcome of your analytics. So, for instance, we use the MacArthur Aging Study, which is a study of folks done by Harvard over a period of years from 65 and older. Those people are one huge group and were studied from 65 to death. With that group, we were able to analyze what biomarkers were evident 3 to 5 years before symptoms became evident. So what you look at is comorbidities and biometrics and blood measurements that you can actually look at from a comorbidity point of view.
First of all, if you're just joining us, you're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm talking with Gordon Horowitz. He's founder and CEO of Allostatics. Allostatics entered into a partnership with OSU's Wexner Medical Center to launch a joint venture. Let's break out stress, for example. How does this brand of analytics measure stress and prescribe stress management practices? How would that work? What would I see?
Okay. What you would see is if you were an individual taking the test, you would get a full report on each one of your body systems as well as a suggested action plan on how to fix it. Our analytics are so accurate that what it allows a physician to do is to examine the measurements, and then because of the measurement, which is both sensitive, which means that it can identify you as a person and what we could do to fix you as a person. In other words, and here is how it looks. Our score comes from a 0 to 300, okay? You and I could have a score of 104. My makeup of that 104 and your makeup of the 104 is completely different. And therefore, how the physicians would fix us is also completely different. What we give the physicians is a roadmap that they can use in their treatment of their patients to be able to examine folks that are currently, by all measurements, asymptomatic, but yet with the comorbidities and the addition of that is going forwards. What our measurement, if you can imagine, Anne, that you had a full glass of water in front of you. And when you were born, that full glass of water would give you the resources you need to till you would live to 85 if nothing else happened to that glass of water. Well, unfortunately, life happens. And that glass of water gets little holes poked in it. And it leaks water all the way out through our lives. And as the level of the water or resources gets small, shorter and shorter, those resources are still spread among the body. But the problem is there's not so many resources because there's holes in the water. So what happens is the resources that are designed to make sure that our body functions perfectly as an ongoing machine are then set lower. Your body is a balanced mechanism. And what it does is it sets a new balance point. And that new balance point divides the resources up thinner and thinner, which causes the body systems to break down. And, you know, my mother, when she died, said to me, I called her a week before she died, and she said to me, "Gordon, I'm just worn out." And I said, "Come on, Mom." And she said, "No, I can feel it. I'm just worn out." And that is the blessing that we are trying to give to people, that they live to 85 and die because they're worn out, not because of some chronic disease state or anything else that shortened their lifespan.
This kind of information that you're collecting, is it the sort of thing we were talking about a little earlier about privacy and that sort of thing? Could it be turned against people? There's some paranoia about that. Paranoia is probably a pejorative. It's not fair to say that. Some people are worried about it.
No, there's absolute paranoia because of the data collection and the amount of data out there. It's a worry, but I can assure you that data comes to us, meaning P4U, in a HIPAA-protected manner, which means it's de-identified files. And when they go back to the individual or the entity that wants to use them, they are still de-identified. And the only person that can identify them is the person with the code that gives you the ability to undo the secret number. And so although I am very cognizant of that worry, I can assure you that our measurement is used to do nothing else but good.
I don't have enough time to go over your background, but you've started a lot of companies and sold a lot of companies. How do you make money doing what you're doing now? How does it work?
Our analytics allow companies and individuals to act before the problem hits. So by doing that, the interventions that we are suggesting are less invasive, obviously less expensive, and are actions that you can take to change your life. I'm not saying that everybody is going to change, but the people that are going to change correctly, and the correct people are going to change because that's what our demographic identifies, the correct people that need to change their lifestyle a little bit. And you're not talking about huge changes. You just, you know, for me, when I did my allostatic load, the thing that brought me peace was that after all the years of seeing my doctor and everything with being in range, when I did my allostatic load, which is 104, and it gave me peace of mind that it wasn't between the 5 inches between my ears. It was actually my entire body that was wearing out. For me, I'm a spinning instructor, so one of the things I had to do was not exercise as hard because I was busy killing myself by exercising too hard.
Okay, so it can be good news.
yes. No. Look, there's plenty of interesting news. We have found people that are large that have wonderful allostatic loads and people that are skinny beans that have terrible allostatic loads. So you can't identify, there's no person, there's no atypical person you can identify. It's your body's reaction to life and what life has thrown at you that we measure. and we help people to identify crises before they happen.
And the relationship, the partnership with OSU's Wexner Medical Center, what do you do with them?
For example, the Wexner Medical Center is probably has some of the best data sources, the best doctors I could ever find. What, for instance, we have already worked out with OSU, for example, is a sleep apnea screen. The medical profession has a real problem with diagnosing sleep apnea without what I call the sleepover camp, where you sit with the electrodes and all that stuff on your head. What we worked with was with the sleep clinic at OSU, and with our analytics developed a sleep apnea screen that will save the doctors an enormous amount of time by using it as a clinical advice tool, not diagnosis, but just advice, and then being able to identify the people that should be going on, stratify them into what type of treatment they should be going for, and then apply the normal stuff that they do. This saves, for instance, OSU with their own medical plan a lot of money by cutting out the false positives that shouldn't be going over to the sleepover camp, for example. So the benefit for OSU is that we arrived at the same point in time. Our analytics needed a good medical home, and I could not be prouder of what we've accomplished through P4 4U at this stage.
Well, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
You are very welcome, man.
Gordon Horwitz, he's the CEO and founder of Allostatics and CEO of P44U. Allostatics MA entered into a partnership with OSU's Wexner Medical Center. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, global weirdness, heat waves, relentless drought, and rising seas. We speak with Michael Lemonick of the group Climate Central, an independent journalism and research organization which has just published a new guide to what we know about the science of climate change and what to expect in the future. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon here on 89.7 NPR News. Deep in the rainforest, veterinarians and caregivers have a massive and emotional task ahead of them, rescuing and nursing the jungle's most appealing and most vulnerable animals back to health. Wednesday night on WOSU-TV, learn about approximately 600 orangutans being cared for day and night. Each day is a challenge for the team as they care for orphans and deal with life in a rainforest hospital. Watch Orangutan Diary Wednesday night at 8 on WOSU-TV. And join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow from 10 until noon, a discussion of presidential politics and the new choice for vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan. Also in the second hour of the program, as the new school year begins, encouraging creativity in children. That is All Sides tomorrow from 10 until noon on 89.7 NPR News. 69 degrees with cloudy skies. There is a chance of rain throughout the day today, a high of 78. Clouds tonight, a low of 60. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Medical technology, the two words put together in a phrase, is a given these days. Everything from health screenings to medications, often cures, are connected to some form of technology these days. In a special edition of Tech Tuesday, we're talking about all of that during a live broadcast of All Sides with Ann Fisher from the OSU Rally for Wellness Health Fair on the campus of Ohio State University. Joining us now is Dr. Ali Razai. He is a world-renowned neurosurgeon whose work with brain pacemakers at Ohio State has transformed the treatment of neurological conditions such as Parkinson's disease and others. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Your research focuses on neurostimulation. You've been working for a while in the area of brain pacemakers. How do they work? Are they like pacemakers for the heart?
Exactly. So this technology has developed over the past decade, and is very analogous to heart pacemakers, and these tiny pacemakers send calming signals to the brain and shut down the electrical activity, the abnormal activity causing Parkinson's, for example, and or treating chronic pain, or treating patients with obsessive compulsive disorder. And in the same way in which cardiac pacemakers and technology over the past 50 years has revolutionized the treatment of heart disorders, brain pacemakers and neurological pacemakers are transforming the way we treat neurological conditions.
And it's transforming it very quickly.
Very correctly, exactly right. So, for example, somebody has a tremor from the Parkinson's, by turning the pacemaker on, the tremor calms down and stops immediately. Or somebody who has difficulty with their hands and movements or arm movements or stiffness, when the pacemaker is turned on, it sends calming signals into the brain that calms the abnormal electrical activity in the brain causing Parkinson's. As a result, the symptoms or the movements improve in the case of Parkinson's. Or if somebody has chronic pain, it reduces the severity of the chronic pain.
I hadn't read about the chronic pain part, and that's interesting because of the drug addiction issues that we have with chronic pain.
Yes.
But how do you know what you can treat with one of these pacemakers?
Well, fundamentally, it has to do about the way we've understood, with advances in neuroscience, how the brain functions in terms of controlling your movements, your sensations, your thinking, your behavior, your emotions, communication. So whether it's a genetic condition or acquired condition that results in Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or traumatic brain injury or stroke or a number of other conditions, we're able to increasingly pinpoint in the brain or the nervous system problem areas that are electrically malfunctioning. As a result, the pacemaker can be used to restore the malfunction in the brain.
You've been working on this for a long time, but our understanding of the brain has really exploded just in the last 10 years.
Absolutely. There's so much growth, and this is a fantastic. Brain is really one of the final frontiers of medicine in terms of knowing what's going on. And you have conditions like Parkinson's, epilepsy, Alzheimer's, autism.
I've heard
epilepsy.
Eating disorders.
Absolutely. And we're actually doing clinical trials at Ohio State with a brain implant for severe obesity, as well as addiction. So there are precise areas in your brain that are abnormally functioning, causing you to be an addict or causing you to seek food. So in the conditions of addictions and severe obesity, it's fundamentally your brain malfunction that's causing the drive to seek for a drug or the drive for eating. And this is a whole new science that's emerging, and it has to do with networks in the brain, or circuits that we call them, that govern your movements, your sensations, your behaviors, your thinking, your personality, your drives, and other elements of human functioning. So these networks are malfunctioning, causing disease processes.
My guest is Dr. Ali Razai. He's professor of neurosurgery and director of the Center for Neuromodulation at OSU. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You've compared the brain to an orchestra playing a symphony. How does electrical stimulation work with that?
So let's take, for example, Parkinson's. In Parkinson's, imagine the central conductor in the brain is a chemical called dopamine. And in Parkinson's, that chemical is missing, dopamine. So if you don't have a conductor, the orchestra is playing chaotic music. Each section is playing on their own. And that's essentially what's happening in Parkinson's, is brain chaos. What the pacemaker does, it regulates the chaos and normalizes the activity of the brain so that all the different systems of the brain are functioning more in sync and together.
And we know this absolutely now. This isn't, but is it still experimental?
No. For Parkinson's, and we've learned so much. We actually have been doing recordings from the human brain, recording electrical chaos. So this has been going on for 20 years of research. But some of the more interesting research in terms of the evolution has to do with patients, for example, who have Alzheimer's, or people with addictions, or obsessive compulsive disorder, depression, where we're able to understand what in the brain underlies problems associated with thinking, with impulsivity, with anxiety, with mood disorders. So brain implants have been explored, and we've been involved in several clinical trials for exploring the use of deep brain stimulation or brain pacemakers for obsessive compulsive disorder, which is now FDA approved therapy, as well as depression, addiction, doing it for epilepsy, obesity, Alzheimer's, autism, a number of areas that are emerging. And that's why I'm calling this in the future, there'll be a transformation in the way we're treating these conditions. And we also go outside the brain, so we're developing implants, tiny microchips like dental implants that we've developed that can be activated with your cell phone-like device. So this is for migraines and cluster headaches. So in European clinical trials that we started, you can do stimulation with a handheld cell phone-like device. So when your migraine comes on or when your headache comes on, you can stop the headaches within 15 minutes of applying your cell phone. So these microchips are being implanted in different parts of the body to treat migraines, to treat conditions like asthma, COPD, irritable bowel syndrome, heart failure. So it's implants not only in the brain, but outside in the nerves that control all body organs.
Sue and Galena, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, I have a question. I'm wondering if these microchips have been used for any of the various ataxia problems.
That's a good question.
Could you tell us what ataxia?
Yes, ataxia is a difficulty with balance and walking and coordination. And no, it has not been applied for ataxia. It's a very complex condition, but it does improve tremor, a condition called dystonia, abnormal contraction of the muscles, and Parkinson's. But unfortunately, they have not shown to be of benefit for ataxia.
Okay, Sue. Thanks, Sue, for that call. Appreciate it. If you have a question or comment for my guest, Dr. Ali Razai, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about brain pacemakers and more. Dr. Razai, questions or comments, 614-292-8513. Let's talk about eating disorders for a second, because that's something that people think is purely behavioral. With something like that, if you were to treat it with something like a brain pacemaker, would you still require counseling and therapy, you know, that kind of thing as well?
That's a great question. And first, I want to just say that for any condition that we do a brain pacemaker implant, patients have had to try all different approaches.
First,
absolutely. Mm-hmm. They've had to try various medications by experts, behavioral therapy, all other means of therapy. And despite those best attempts at optimizing those medications and therapies, they have failed and they are struggling and suffering and having a progressive disability in their functioning. That's when pacemakers can be potentially of benefit. So it's not a first line of therapies for those with very advanced conditions that have failed medications. But what's driving this technology is that we're understanding what's going on in the brain. So for example, many studies looking at brain imaging are showing that in those individuals who have obesity, a specific part of the brain involved in the impulsiveness, in the reward-seeking behavior, same part of the brain that's malfunctioning in patients with alcoholics or have drug addictions, that part of the brain is also malfunctioning in obese individuals. So really, it's a behavioral condition that's manifested by electrical abnormality in the brain. So it's got a fundamental physiological foundation in the brain that's driving the obesity or that's driving the addiction. But no question, whether you do medications or behavioral therapy or lifestyle changes, they're all helping the treatment. So behavioral therapy, for example, is also rewiring the brain. So is medication. So all these elements, as well as a brain pacemaker as a last resort, helps to improve the abnormal functioning of the brain, to really rewire the brain to a more normal functioning.
Sharon and Gahanna, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. My sister was diagnosed a year ago with MSA, and I wondered if the implant would have any effect on the autonomic nervous system.
MSA,
multisystem atrophy. MSA also is another condition that mimics Parkinson's-like movements. And unfortunately, not for MSA. So these pacemakers work for the standard Parkinson's, the idiopathic Parkinson's that we call it. There are a number of conditions that mimic Parkinson's in terms of the shaking and the stiffness and difficulty walking and so on. But this therapy has been approved and most studied for Parkinson's. We are looking at MSA and Huntington's disease and other conditions, but these are all very early clinical trials. So I can't give you an answer. We hope to have better answers in a few years. But at this point, unfortunately, it does not work for MSA.
Sharon, thanks for your call. Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye. You mentioned it's the not necessarily a last resort, but it's after other treatments have been tried. And you mentioned failed medications. Is there ever a time when medication, even if it is working, has other side effects that make say the brain pacemaker more appropriate? And then we can get into the side effects of the brain pacemaker for that matter. But is it, if the medication's working, that's not always necessarily better.
Well, medications are not without side effects. So a lot of times medications, and really any medication, can cause side effects, whether it's from GI upsets, you can have difficulty with digestion or pains in the stomach, or it can affect your thinking, it can cloud your thinking, it can make you sleepier, it can affect really all different systems of the body can be affected by medications. And taking the pill analogy I've used in the past is that when you take medications, the medication has to go into your stomach and have to go inside your bloodstream and bathe your whole body from head to toe before it gets to the area it needs to go. It's non-specific. It's really systemic therapy, whereas with the pacemaker or these microinfusion devices, we're going exactly to the problem area. And it's like having a car that's run out of gas, and you bring a tanker truck and pour thousands of gallons of gasoline over the car to make it get going again, versus we take a syringe and go directly into the gas tank with mm-hmm. it. So medications can be of benefit and should be explored, but they are not without side effects. A lot of medications does not work. For example, in Alzheimer's, there's a lot of limitations as far as what can be applied. So that's where this new technology comes in that can potentially help patients take them beyond the medication's limitations or side effects. And over time, with Parkinson's patients, we've been doing these surgeries for 15 years now. Over time, we're having patients who are already functioning, well-functioning, working and doing well, but they have beginning Parkinson's, and they say they don't want to take medications for years before they're coming to surgery, so they're coming on earlier and earlier for surgery.
Veronica in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much. I would like to ask the doctor about clinical trials. We have a family member who he's experienced a motorcycle accident and traumatic brain injury, and it's totally changed his life. And he shows and has shown over the last 3 years behaviors that the doctor has already spoken about. The compulsive behavior, addiction, or use of alcohol, and judgment, impulsivity, those kinds of things. And I wanted to ask how, if those are available, how can we find out about clinical trials? How can we inquire about them if it might be considered?
And actually, that's a great question. And indeed, we do have a clinical trial that we've been performing, this first in the world trial at Ohio State, for the past 2 years with our colleagues, Dr. Corrigan and Miss Hsu at the PM&R department here. And basically, exactly right, traumatic brain injury, depending on where the injury is, can result in paralysis, can result in impulsivity, can result in memory problems, cognitive problems, behavioral self-regulation, impulsivity, addictive behavior, depending on what part of the brain is damaged from a trauma, from a fall, from accident, etc. So we do have a trial, ongoing trial, that we've already been performing for the past 2 years at Ohio State, where we have a pacemaker implanted in the part of the brain involved in behavioral self-regulation to improve brain connectivity, interaction with the environment, surroundings, and to improve a lot of these behaviors that you are referring to. So we indeed have a trial ongoing, and we are seeing some preliminary interesting results that are positive, so we're very excited about this trial and the potential of brain pacemakers helping patients with severe traumatic brain injury.
When you say it's a trial ongoing, is that something where you're still taking people into it?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Veronica, thanks a lot for your call. I want to move on to Terry in Canal Winchester. Hi, Terry. Maybe they'll just put you right on with me. Oh.
Thank you.
Yeah. Hi, Terry.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I find this intriguing, especially the addiction. I have son with problems with opiates, and I'm curious to how soon this might reach the street level, the common man.
Great question. Again, the addictions have to be treated with behavioral adjustments, medications, and all other approaches. But there's been clinical trials ongoing in this in Europe for patients with opium and opiate addictions, and also in Asia, as well as initial trials starting in the U.S. Hopefully sometime next year. And the trials are demonstrating with the brain pacemaker that the areas involved in addiction are resulting in improvements in abstinence behavior. And we at OSU are working with a National Institute of Health on a trial for severe alcoholism as well, involving a brain pacemaker. So why are we doing this? Because there are specific parts of the brain that are malfunctioning or electrically misfiring that are resulting in the craving and addictive behavior. So these are the reward centers in the brain that are not functioning properly and driving the addictive behavior. In severe cases where they have disabled somebody and devastated their quality of life and functioning, a brain pacemaker may be an option. So definitely it's being done outside the U.S., and hopefully within a year there will be trials in the U.S. for severe addictions.
Thank you, Terry, for that call. What about the actual surgery to implant the pacemakers? What is that like? How intrusive is it? Does it hurt?
No. It is surgery.
Does it hurt when you think?
Well, actually, it's interesting. The brain does not hurt, so the brain is insensate. Yeah. So we just numb up the scalp like the dentists do. They numb up your teeth. But the surgery, in the old days when we were doing this in Europe, it used to take 12 hours, but now it takes about 3 hours. In fact, this morning we did a case we were done about an hour ago. So we did a brain pacemaker implant on a patient with Parkinson's. And so it takes about 3 hours, the surgery now. And we map the brain. We have tiny microphones, hair-like microphones, that record abnormal brain activity until we find the right area causing the Parkinson's, and then we place the pacemaker there. And you see the effects immediately. Like this morning in the patient, the tremor stopped. She had tremor for many years, and it stopped on the table.
Right off the bat.
Right off the bat, and as well as the stiffness and rigidity. So surgery takes about 3 hours. And in the near future, it will be done in an outpatient setting, in an MRI, where the brain chip is implanted.
You know, some are weary of this and have been weary of it because of the psychiatric surgery, I guess, boom of the early and mid-20th century. You know, the lobotomies, the electroshock therapy. Now, electroshock therapy is, there's another word for it now, but it's coming back. Have people been naysayers about this? Are people confused about it? Are they concerned? In terms of that, where someone will just be doing it remotely now, I won't have a doctor sitting there talking with me about it anymore, and then that will become disconnected from it.
Well, so you bring a good point in terms of the lobotomy era. And those were in the days where there were lobotomies done that they were destroying large parts of the brain. We are in a completely different era than those days. First of all, these are patients that have failed all kinds of medications, and we have a multidisciplinary team of psychiatrists, psychologists, neurologists, neurosurgeons. Everything goes to the Food and Drug Administration, Institutional Review Board. So before we can start on anything of this sort, it takes 3 or 5 years before we can get there. Second, science and technology has advanced to the point where we can pinpoint with millimeter precision specific parts of the brain that are underlying anxiety, depression, obsessions, compulsions. And once patients have failed all approaches, all medications as determined by psychiatrists and specialists, and all behavioral and psychotherapy, and their quality of life is severely disabled, this surgery can be an option. We implant a precise pacemaker that is the size of a grain of rice and basically can be implanted and improve the function in a reversible, adjustable fashion. You can turn the pacemaker off, you're back to where you started. So it's adjustable and reversible and dynamic therapy.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us today to tell us about it.
Welcome. My pleasure.
Dr. Ali Rezai, he's professor of neurosurgery and director of the Center for Neuromodulation at The Ohio State University. I want to thank the staff for helping out with this program. AllSides producer Amy Jurovich, AllSides intern Corinne Guckler, AllSides production assistants Rachel Ramey and Leticia Wiggins, AllSides volunteer Andrew Sweet. We're going to miss Andrew on our regular Tech Tuesdays, with video production by Richard and Amber Kazmiski. Thanks for listening. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.